Hey there, and welcome to Making Positive Psychology Work, the weekly podcast where we uncover tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, so together we can better navigate the incredible challenges and opportunities our world faces. I'm your host, Michelle McQuaid, and what you probably don't know about me is that in order to complete my Masters of Applied Positive Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, I had to fly from Melbourne to Philadelphia, that's about a 22-hour trip each way, to attend class every 3 weeks. Luckily, I was studying grit. Thank you so much for joining me for this special edition of Making Positive Psychology Work in partnership with the European Conference on Positive Psychology and the Positive Psychology Program. I'm so glad you're here today because we're talking to James Pawelski, who's the Director of Education and Senior Scholar in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. James has served as the founding director of the Masters of Applied Positive Psychology Program for over 10 years, where he teaches courses on positive interventions and the humanities and human flourishing. An international keynote speaker who regularly makes presentations in Spanish as well as English, he has given talks in more than 20 countries on 6 continents. He holds a number of key leadership positions, including founding executive director of the International Positive Psychology Association, member of the steering committee of the International Positive Education Network, and president of the William James Society. He's been featured in major US and international media, and is the author of The Dynamic Individualism of William James. But what you probably don't know about James is that he and his wife Susie have a delightful 5-year-old son named Liam. Welcome, James.
Thank you so much, Michelle. It's great to be with you today.
It's great to talk to you, James, because I know you recently spoke at the wonderful European Conference on Positive Psychology on what is positive psychology, the importance of theory for research and practice. What were you hoping people would take away from your session?
Well, so my background, certainly I've been working in the area of psychology for many years, but my training, my PhD, is actually in the humanities. It's in philosophy. And so I like to ask questions that a lot of other people may not ask, and I like to ask them to the level that many other people may not ask them, but there are some really interesting things that happen when you ask careful questions deeply. I like to think of positive psychology as a tree, as a fruit tree. And in the almost 20 years since it was started, the empirical branches have been growing really strongly, and the practical fruit is now appearing in many different kinds of application for that fruit. And so it's very rich, very powerful. And yet if you look at a picture of a tree, or if you walk in the park next to a tree, you don't see one of the most important parts of that tree. And the likelihood is that the root system may be just as deep as the tree is tall and maybe just as complex. And it's the root system that provides the nourishment that the tree needs and the stability that it needs to stand firm in storms and even just on normal days, right? So I think of theory as the kind of the root system of positive psychology. And I'm interested in making sure that that root system is developed and grown at least as deeply as the branches and the fruit are above ground. And so I think that it's important to think about philosophical questions, the philosophical underpinnings, or theoretical questions, because they're so closely related to and so important for research and practice. Plus, if you're a philosopher, they're just interesting in their own right.
I know you like to question everything deeply, James, from having sat in many of your classes. And I know one of the questions you've been considering about that tree and those theoretical roots is exactly what does positive psychology mean by positive? So what are you finding?
Exactly. So if we start at the very basic, most simple question that oftentimes we don't even think about because it seems so simple, oftentimes we get some really interesting results. And at this stage, even now, again, into its adolescence, let's say late adolescence of positive psychology, it's still easy to misunderstand the discipline. I suspect that many of us have had the experience I just had about a week ago again, where I mentioned that I was involved with positive psychology and someone someone said, oh, is that the opposite of negative psychology? Right. And I, you know, you laugh and you say, well, no, actually not. But why is it that that question keeps coming up? Well, if we ask the question, what is positive psychology? It leads us to the question, what is the positive itself? Mm-hmm. And so if we look to the early beginnings of the field of positive psychology, we see various statements, various definitions of what the positive is. So Martin Seligman, in his founding presidential address to the American Psychological Association, in which he announced the field of positive psychology, and then in the introduction to the special issue of positive psychology mm-hmm. in the millennial issue of American Psychologist, Marty Seligman and Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi wrote some definitions as well. And then I'm pulling also from Marty Seligman's early book, Authentic Happiness, 2002. And if we look in those texts, what we find is that positive psychology is defined, first of all, as an orientation. So it's complementary to the negative direction, or the mainstream psychology focuses on what's negative in life. Positive psychology kind of does a 180, right? Mm-hmm. It focuses yeah. on what's positive. And then if we look in that direction, then what do you see, right? So instead of the negative of, you know, depression and anxiety and schizophrenia, you see the positive of gratitude and joy and optimism and courage and so mm-hmm. forth. So positive psychology will focus on positive topics. The target population, whereas mainstream psychology is mainly focused on clinical populations, positive psychology will focus on populations who are already healthy but could be healthier, mm-hmm. right? And then processes. So instead of focusing on repairing what is worst, positive psychology wants to build up what is best. And then finally, the ultimate goal of positive psychology is the good life. That is to say, positive psychology is about trying to help us all learn how to live our lives in a way that we can maximize the potentials that we have and live the best life that we can. So if you think of all those different definitions, there are some key tricky questions that arise from that. And if you're up for it, Michelle, maybe we can just investigate a couple of those questions.
Go for it. I think it's important we investigate those questions.
Great. So the first one is, what is the relation between the positive and the negative, right? So if you're thinking about the mathematical metaphor, you'd say, well, the relation is there isn't one, right? I mean, if the number mm-hmm. is positive, yeah. it's not negative. If it's negative, it's not positive. And we tend to think about things that way. And so in some ways, the positive and the negative seem to be independent. But then there are other situations where it seems like the positive may have an effect on the negative parts of our life. The positive seems to be a buffer against the negative. So, for example, gratitude may protect us against mm-hmm. depression, right? Mm-hmm. And then finally, we might say, well, you know, the other way it sometimes works too. The negative sometimes seems to enable the positive. Mm-hmm. You remember yeah. Nietzsche's famous quote, that which does not kill me makes yep. me stronger, right?
Absolutely.
And so positive psychologists like to study post-traumatic growth. So sometimes mm-hmm. the negative can actually facilitate or open the door to the positive. So there's it's a complex relation that the positive and the negative have, and it's something that we ought to consider more carefully.
I think that's so true and often misunderstood in the field, both by people in the field and people outside mm-hmm. of the field. Mm-hmm. So, James, what are some of the other questions we should be considering in terms of what this definition of the positive means for us as researchers and practitioners in the field?
Yeah, so here's another question, Michelle, and this one may be my favorite one because I think it gets really to the root, if I may say, of so many of the confusions, as you mentioned, that happen within the field and also that make positive psychology to be a needlessly large target for critics. So here's the question. Is positive psychology fundamentally about the best things in life, or is it fundamentally about living the best life we can?
Ooh. So what are you finding?
Well, so if it's about the best things in life, well, then it's about gratitude and joy and optimism and courage and so forth. But if it's about living the best life we can, I don't know about you, but although I do have some of those things in my life, I have some things in my life that I would not categorize as the best things in life.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And so a challenge, I think, is if we think of positive psychology as being only about the best things in life, then what happens when something comes into our life that's not one of those best things? Does that mean we've somehow failed? Does that mean positive psychology has nothing to say to us? And so I think, personally, that positive psychology is about both of those things in different modes, right? So it's about the best things in life in its complementary mode, in the mode in which it's complementary to mainstream psychology, which focuses on some of the challenges, some of the difficulties and hard things about life. And I think there's a comprehensive mode in positive psychology where it's really focusing on how can we live our lives the best we can given all that is in our lives. And I'd like to use a metaphor. You know, there are people, there are scientists every day who go to work and study vitamins. Mm-hmm. And they study the impact of those vitamins, vitamin A, vitamin B, vitamin C. Now, I am really glad that they do that. And I benefit from the scientific knowledge they create. Even so, when it comes time for me to have lunch, I don't simply get heaping tablespoons full of vitamin A, vitamin B, vitamin C, and dump them on my plate, right? Mm-hmm. What I want to do is I want to have a balanced diet. And so that means certainly taking into account what they recommend. But honestly, sometimes it means taking things off of my plate.
Yeah.
Right? And so the comprehensive approach to positive psychology, I think, is an important thing to keep in mind so that we don't simply think that the answer to all questions about life is, well, just try to feel better, right? Try to increase your joy, or try to have a little more gratitude and you'll be just fine, because we're all living very complex lives that require a comprehensive approach to try to move in the direction of human flourishing.
Absolutely. I think there is always that danger that in our enthusiasm for some of the research or practices that we see in positive psychology and the hope for the difference that they can make, that we perhaps have a tendency to take them and use them like blunt tools rather than the intelligent instruments that they are, and to be able to appreciate that complexity and understanding in this situation for this outcome, what of all the different tools I have to draw on will serve me best? Is this a moment for gratitude, or is this perhaps a moment for something different in order to maximize the learning opportunity that continues to move me towards that good life? Now, I know you'll have an endless list of questions that you've been asking about this, but give us one more. What's another question that we should be thinking more about as researchers and practitioners based on what you've been finding as you've kind of tried to sort out the roots of this tree of positive psychology?
Sure, yeah. So another question is, what happens if various positives are in conflict? So what happens, for example, I mean, let me ask you a fairly graphic question.
Go for it.
Would you like to have someone slice your stomach open with a knife?
I'd rather not, generally.
That probably isn't one of those best things in life, right? Mm-hmm. But let me tell you the rest of the story. Let's say you've just been diagnosed with acute appendicitis.
Mm-hmm.
And the prognosis
cut open.
Cut away, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Then you would be happy to have that life-saving surgery. So I think one of the things that is being noticed by researchers more in the last couple of years especially is this question of what happens when there are conflicts. So for example, Todd Kashtan and Robert Biswas-Diener have published The Upside of Your Dark Side. Mm-hmm. So they point out that sometimes those things which we consider to be negative can actually have positive consequences. Emotions, for example, things like guilt. We might not like feeling guilty, but boy, it keeps us in line, right?
It does. Yep.
And then there's a book on positive emotions, integrating the light side and the dark side. And they point out that sometimes positive emotions have good results, but sometimes positive emotions in the wrong context can actually cause problems.
Absolutely.
Right? So again, just to the point that you were saying about context, it's important to understand not only how we can act in the world, not only how we can change the world, but a lot of programs for changing the world have actually gone awry, right? And there's a lot of damage that's been done throughout history by people who've been trying to change the world in ways that weren't contextually appropriate, that didn't really help, you know, move us all toward human flourishing. So understanding these various levels of the positive, for example, positive states, emotional states, how am I feeling right now? Positive traits like character, strengths, and so forth. Positive processes like, you know, I'm undergoing this learning process, right? And then the outcome. And sometimes we may have to, you mentioned flying to the United States, you know, every 3 weeks, and I'm amazed at your stamina in being able to do that. And I suspect there probably were one or two moments on those long plane rides where you would have been just as happy not to be traveling for 22 hours straight. And yet you did it, Michelle, because you were committed to the outcome, which was a positive outcome that you
Absolutely.
Stuck to, and it has indeed been a benefit in your life.
Absolutely. So, James, as we think about this more comprehensive, intelligent approach to the good life, how does that actually bear fruit practically? And I know one of your passions in particular is around looking at that in the area of the humanities. So perhaps can you give us some examples? Well, if we start to understand this theory, we start to understand the research more, what does it look like in terms of the fruit practically?
Absolutely. Yeah. So if we think about positive psychology, especially in its comprehensive mode, then the collaboration becomes really important. So there are a variety of disciplines and domains that focus, at least in part, on trying to think about how we can make our lives and the world a better place. And the humanities, disciplines like philosophy and history and religion, literature, and then the arts, things like music and theater and the visual and performing arts. Creators and thinkers in these domains have been thinking about questions of the good life for millennia in many different cultures. And so one of the things that I'm excited about, given my own background in the humanities, is trying to foster dialogue between the science of well-being and the culture of human flourishing. I think that the humanities are a rich repository for positive psychologists, for example, to look at, because there's so much incredible information about human experience and the quest for the good life. I think that the humanities can help guide the science of positive psychology. For example, we just talked about a conceptual analysis. What does positive psychology mean by the positive? That's really a kind of philosophical methodology, a philosophical investigation. So these roots have a lot to do with philosophy. And then third, I would say that it's important for the positive psychology to think about the humanities from the standpoint of positive interventions. I imagine that both you and I and everyone listening to this podcast would agree that very important parts of our lives, part of our well-being, are connected to things like music and art and literature, poetry, novels, and so on. I mean, imagine our world without any of these things. Well-being would really take a hit.
Right? Absolutely. It'd be very gray.
Yeah, exactly. So we can think of the humanities in part as a kind of whole new domain of positive interventions. Again, it's one of those ones that we rely on probably every day, but we typically don't think about it in the domain of positive psychology interventions. And I think we ought to, because it's a very promising direction to go in.
I completely agree. And a lot of our listeners particularly think about the application of positive psychology in workplaces. And I think this is an area where the humanities is very underappreciated. So if we were to think about workplaces wanting to improve well-being to help their employees flourish more consistently, what do you see perhaps as some of the intersection between interventions you've been looking at for the humanities in general, for the good life, but what organizations might be able to draw more heavily upon?
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is research that I'm now leading on the Humanities and Human Flourishing Project. And so we're now gathering colleagues and networks and resources so that we can go into this in a very collaborative way, looking at the humanities and what they bring to the well-being table and how we can have a collaboration between the humanities and empirical research in the science, both to advance the humanities and to advance science, but most of all, to advance humanity, right? And so thinking specifically about the workplace, one of my colleagues here at the University of Pennsylvania at the Wharton School of Business, who teaches the introductory year one class for management students in our business school, got her PhD in poetry. And so she is a humanities scholar. And we've been talking about the importance of thinking about literature for leadership, right? And if you think about literature or art or music, oftentimes there is a lot of subtlety, a lot of wisdom, a lot there that we oftentimes simply miss. And so I think for the workplace, I would say two things. One, most of us who go to work are human, and most days at least we feel human, right? And the humanities can help us stay connected to that humanness, right? Absolutely. And then secondly, the humanities are being used in all kinds of workplaces to help hone the ability to observe keenly, to try to understand layers down what's really happening in my work environment. So I don't simply, you know, take things for granted and assume that things are the way they are when actually they may be quite different.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking of workplaces I've been in and how they would have benefited perhaps in our strategy sessions from more philosophical questioning about what we were trying to achieve. I think about the move in so many organizations where they're now running classes on storytelling because they've seen the power of stories and the fact that often in organizations, while we're great at using facts and data, we're often not very good at telling the human story. And yet we know it's that human story that connects with our hearts and, you know, lights up our brains, and it's often what we remember long after the data has kind of dissipated. So I can see all sorts of fascinating intersections for interventions in the area of humanities and the positive psychologies and workplaces. And yet to me, it's an area so far in positive psychology that hasn't been widely discussed. So I'm looking forward to seeing what comes out of your project and the research as you go forward.
Thank you, Michelle. Yes, I agree with you. That was very well said. And again, I think that it's one of these things that it's like fish living in water don't realize that they're living in water, or we don't always think about the fact that we're breathing oxygen. And so the stories that we tell sometimes unconsciously to ourselves have such power over us. And then certainly the stories that we tell as groups and as societies are incredibly important for our well-being.
Absolutely. Now, James, are you ready for the lightning round?
Sure, absolutely.
So what's the most useful positive psychology tool or learning that you've applied in your own life and why?
So I would say the values in action classification of strengths and virtues, which is an approach that allows you to focus specifically on the signature strengths, the key strengths that we each have. And when I was in high school, if somebody had asked me, my top signature strength is creativity. But if you had asked me in high school how creative I was, I would say I have zero creativity. You know why? Because I couldn't draw, right? So I thought, because I can't draw, therefore I'm not. And now I realize there are a lot of ways of being creative. You can be creative with ideas. You can be creative with so many things. So that's been really helpful in helping me to kind of lean into the strengths and own these strengths and develop them further in my own life.
I think that's a beautiful observation. James, what would you recommend as the must-read book for people wanting to bring out the best in themselves and others in workplaces, and why?
So now this is going to be a little bit of a different recommendation than I suspect you and your listeners are used to, but I would recommend two pieces of literature. One is kind of a cautionary tale, and the other is more of an exemplar. The cautionary tale is The Death of Ivan Illich by Leo Tolstoy. And not to give too much of the story away, but here's a picture. This is a story of a guy who did everything he was supposed to do at work, right? I mean, he was a lawyer. He was promoted, became a judge. And yet his life didn't turn out so well because he hadn't focused on the key things that are important for well-being. Contrasting with that is Willa Cather's great short story, Neighbor Ozicki, about an immigrant to the United States who had a very tough life and yet lived his life and made his choices based on valuing relationships, listening to his own inner voices and not trying to push away and shut away reality. And because he faced things squarely, he was able to have a work environment that was very different, one wherein he didn't necessarily have a legacy of billions of dollars to leave to the next generation. But what he did have was an amazing family, amazing relationships with those people, and a life and a death that I think most of us would envy.
Great recommendations. I'm going to go and grab both of those and have a read. James, what are you reading right now and are you enjoying it?
Yeah, well, I mean, goodness gracious, my colleague here at the Positive Psychology Center has just published a fabulous book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. And not only is she just a phenomenal researcher and a great writer and just an amazing human being and great friend. So I totally recommend that book. I'm also reading some books on mindfulness meditation. Mm-hmm. And we talked earlier in our conversation, Michelle, a little bit about the importance of context, right? So of being aware of what's going on inside and what's going on outside before we, you know, get out there and change the world, darn it.
Absolutely.
And I think, again, that's part of what made Neighbor Ozicki so successful, is he was aware of these things, whereas Ivan Illich tried to push them away. So I'm really interested and would recommend folks do some more investigation into this emerging field of mindfulness meditation, which itself is enjoying a lot of empirical support these days.
Absolutely. And I so enjoyed reading Angela Duckworth's book on grit. And if people haven't read it yet, I would add it to the recommendations. James, if there was one thing you wished everybody thought about when it comes to implementing positive psychology in workplaces, what would it be?
Well, I would say that, you know, I'm not a fan of the term optimism, because optimism in philosophy, the word was coined in philosophy, to mean this is basically the world is great, right? It's the best of all possible worlds, Leibniz, the philosopher, argued. And I think that that can sometimes send the wrong message. I like the word meliorism better. Meliorism comes from the Latin, not best like optimism does, but better. So it's a kind of, we see the world as a place that can be made better. And William James, my favorite philosopher, was very much developed and believed in meliorism. And so I like to think of a balanced meliorism, where how can we make the world better? One way is by being active, both by moving towards those things that we want, that we prefer, so the positive psychology side of things, but also not forgetting the importance of being able to move away from those things that are harmful to us. So thinking about the mainstream psychology perspective. But then again, balancing the agency, the activity, with also the awareness, and being aware of our inner worlds and being aware of our outer worlds, and bringing all that together to move us forward, so that in our individual lives, in our communities, our families, our companies, and our world, we can all move together toward human flourishing.
I think that's a very important observation for us. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michelle. It was great to be with you.
And thank you for listening. This interview was produced in partnership with the European Conference on Positive Psychology and the Positive Psychology Program. For more about the conference, please visit empp.eu. And for more about the Positive Psychology Program, please visit positivepsychologyprogram.com. And for more of James's wonderful work, please visit jamespowelski.com and the Learning Library at ipanetwork.org. As always, we'll put these URLs in the show notes to help you. You've been listening to Making Positive Psychology Work with Michelle McQuaid. For the notes from today's show and more tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, be sure to head on over to michellemcquaid.com. And if you'd like to perform a random act of kindness today, then be sure to share this podcast with a friend or colleague to help improve our workplaces. After all, as William James wisely said, our view of the world is truly shaped by what we decide to hear. Until next time, take care.